Because the folks who think there's one solution that will fix it may be the solution that fixes it for them, but
Yeah.
that solution may really compromise someone else's opportunity to be there and what they want out of that space. And that's worth considering as well. There's what the place is, why it was protected, what type of experience managers want visitors to have, and that could be along a spectrum. And then how do we manage for that kind of experience or that spectrum of experiences and opportunities? And it's more complex and wicked than build a new parking space and everything will be fixed. And so that, and I'm not saying that's not a potential recommendation or solution to a part of the problem, but it's not the silver bullet that will resolve everything happening in the club.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just crazy. A lot of people don't realize, especially like the people who have newly come here and stuff like that, and some people who have been here a long time, that these places are thriving, these small towns around here.
The bushwhacks were some of the worst days I've ever had in the mountains, or life, really.
And I tell people all the time, never underestimate the Catskills. You can't underestimate them.
Why the Catskills is such a great place for trout.
It is really the development of New York State. Catskills were responsible.
Now you're listening to Inside the Line, the Catskills.
So Abby, where are you located right now?
Right now, I'm in Essex Junction, Vermont, which is just to the east of Burlington.
So are you getting this crazy smoke?
I think we're getting a little, and I walked the dog this morning. It was a little thicker in the air. But I don't think it's too bad out my window right
Oh.
now. Is it bad?
Oh, like if you can see, if I turn my light off, like the outside looks like apocalypse.
Oh, no, we don't have that.
Yeah, it's very dark. I went out hiking this morning and it's tough to breathe. It's just really weird. And I've never had something like this. I know we've had smoke up here before from the Canadian wildfires, but nothing this thick. It's just
Oh,
it's in
boy.
yeah, I can't believe you guys are getting it. Like it looks like it. Like I looked at the map and it looked like it was swooping down in the same spot. So,
I mean, I think I can see some blue sky. But maybe it's headed our way. You know, I used to think settling on the East Coast, and I'm originally from Ohio, so I've moved east across New York State and then up. And I used to think settling here is really safe from a lot of those environmental concerns and natural resource issues like water and temperate climates and actual winter and lack of forest fire, but maybe it's gonna get us anyway.
yeah, it's like seriously, I'm looking outside and it looks apocalyptic, kind of like it's just really odd. And I've, like I said, going outside and breathing is actually, it's not like tough, like you're not like, but you're just like, man, this doesn't smell the same as,
Noticeable. Ooh.
yeah, crisp upstate air that we have.
Yeah.
So be like everybody, be thankful of what we usually have 99% of the year, because that this is. It smells like smog. That's what it to me it is. It's the city, and I don't want that. Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. Also, my friend Dylan is on the Appalachian Trail right now, and he's about 700 miles in. And I just wanted to give a big shout out to him because he is kicking some butt and he's loving it. And I see his stories all the time on Facebook, and I love it. I love seeing that. Have you had any friends participate in the Appalachian Trail?
I've had some friends who do some section hiking, not friends who fully committed. I've run into folks out on the trails and at various hostels that are or have done the whole through hike.
That's
But
cool.
yeah, not directly. Where is Dylan right now? Where is the 700-mile mark?
He said he is in, I think it's North Carolina, the Dragon's Tooth, right outside of that. Oh no, Virginia. Dragon's Tooth and McAfee Knob in Virginia. So like
Oh, yeah.
the iconic point in the Appalachian Trail. So he's really kicking it, and he is having a good time, and he's getting really good weather. Hopefully this will stay away from him. Because
Ooh.
it'll be a pain in the butt to hike through this, especially, I mean, it wouldn't be higher up at this time, but yeah, it would be definitely a difficult time. So, but yeah, just wanted to give a shout out to Dylan because he is killing it on the trail. I can't wait to hear more stories. Also, I have participated now in what the Alzheimer's Association's Longest Day event, and it's a fundraiser for Alzheimer's, of course. And the longest day, of course, is June 21st. And so far, my team and me for the podcast has raised $920, and our goal is $1,000. So it's pretty crazy. Yeah,
you're gonna get there.
We definitely are. And I just had, I know this was a week ago or a couple days ago, so this will be out on Monday. So once again, this is Tuesday, June 6th, everyone. So last week, I got an email from an anonymous person that said, if anybody donates from now to the 11th at it, like from here, from like $0 to $250, that person will match that. So if we get $250 between now and the 11th, which will be by the time this next one airs, they will match that. So I thought that would be pretty neat. And it'll definitely get us over that $1,000 mark, and we will reach our goal. So
awesome.
Crazy. Yeah. Whoever that anonymous person is, thank you. Glad you listened to the show or either follow me on social media, because couldn't imagine they'd known otherwise. So crazy.
Do you have a hike planned for the 21st for the longest day?
Yeah, we are going to hit up Overlook Mountain in the Catskills for a sunset hike.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I got to work. So that brings us a little bit later in the day. I get out at 2:00. So we'll just hit probably someplace to eat and then go up to Overlook and watch the sunset and then come back down. Very easy, nice hike. I don't know if you've ever been to Overlook Mountain.
I have not.
Okay. When you're down there doing your research and stuff, check it out. It's the best. Don't go on the weekends, though. Please don't go on the weekends.
Okay.
It's insane there. But if you guys, anybody wants to join, let me know. June 21st. It's going to be a Wednesday. I don't know what time we're going to hit it up, but I know we're going to be on the road by like 2:30. So it'll definitely be a first sunset hike. So, and to whoever has donated so far for the Alzheimer's Association longest day hike, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. I can't believe how far we've gotten. Just awesome. Thank you once again. All right. So welcome to episode 79 of Inside the Line, the Catskill Mountains podcast. I am here with Abby Larkin of OTAC, who is doing a study in the Catterskill Clove, which is called a VUM, Visitors Use Management. Am I correct, Abby?
Correct.
Okay. And we're going to talk about what the process they go through tonight, basically what she's done and what they're thinking about in the Catskills, because this is a huge deal down in the Catterskills Clove area. As we all know, that it is way overused, way small, not enough space to do many things. And so Abby here, I remember going to the meeting in Hunter that they had, and they have done some crazy intense studies around the United States at these places. She said one of the places, Acadia National Park, Zion, Rainier. So they have been through this stuff, and I can't wait to talk about it, Abby. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking your time and joining me on this. I'm glad you could. So also thank you to the monthly supporters, Darren White, Vicky Ferreira, John Kaminsky, Jim C., Michael Bongner, David Mead, Matt Smith, and Sharon Klein. Thank you guys for donating to the show. Also, Outdoor Chronicles Photography, they are the sponsor of the show, one of the sponsors. Molly from Outdoor Chronicles Photography specializes in adventure elopement and adventure couple photography in the Catskills, Adirondacks, and White Mountains. Don't forget your pets, though. They are just as important. She is also an officiant for getting married and a licensed guide, so don't hesitate to get a hold of Molly on all platforms. Also, have you ever wanted to learn more about hiking or backpacking, or even maybe brush up on some of your old skills in the backcountry? Check out Trailbound Project. They are a hiking backpacking school run by my friends Joe and Scott from this New Jersey Search and Rescue team, and they are there to teach you new and old school skills of hiking and backpacking. Check them out on all their website and social media platforms. They do amazing stuff. I can't wait to see what they're doing next. Joe and Scott got a hold of me for them doing a bushwhack hike in the Catskills sometime. And it's going to be a surprise to the people that are learning up to do their bushwhacking skills. So it's going to be a total crazy intense time. So hopefully they have fun, but check them out. So Abby, usually when we're doing this, you're probably on the clock right now. We have something to drink, like an alcoholic beverage. I don't have anything because I just got back from work. So I wish I could have something. I'm going to try some. I was just down in South Carolina I was in Hilton Head Island and we got some Hilton Head Island rum. So I plan on having a rum and Coke tonight. What's your usual, do you have any alcoholic beverages, usual drink of choice?
Yeah, I'll go for a good beer this time of year. I think over the weekend I had some pretty good sours. They go well with the warmer weather.
Do you have any locals that you want to shout out to?
Oh my gosh. Well, calling out of Vermont, everything is local in Vermont. Vermont takes its local products. They're very proud of them. So I live near a couple of breweries, including Zero Gravity puts out some good stuff and Four Quarters as well, I would say. Nice. But you can't really drive far without hitting a local brewery in my area.
I could imagine, you know, up here too, as well, because I live a little bit further upstate from the city, but
yeah.
Yeah. And Vermont, you're right. They do take their pride in their local. That's good.
And I used to live in the Syracuse, then Clinton, then Saratoga region of New York State. And many years ago now, and even at that point, there were a lot of local breweries cropping up, and I'm sure there's just more nowadays. So it's good stuff coming out of Vermont and New York State.
I agree. Yeah. So excellent. Yeah. We usually have something to drink, but fortunately not tonight. I'll have that later.
Just water for now.
Same. Good old water bottle. Have you gone any on hiking? Any previous hikes you want to chat about in the past like week or two or so?
Not so much in the past week or two. This past weekend, I was focused on my front yard. This is my first summer as a homeowner. And so we had a lot of work to do to undo some of the damage of the previous owner and try to set it up and looking right and learning all these new skills to do that. So that's been a focus lately. And we've had some poor weather as well at times. So haven't gotten out on a hike, but definitely thinking about it heading into the prime of the summer. The last time I was probably out in the woods was when I was in your area for the public meeting and got myself over to the Falls and the Clove to check it out.
What'd you think?
Very impressive sights. A little scary on the Clove, 23A.
Yeah.
And a different sort of vibe being in on the trails between the Falls and Laurel House Road all the way down to 23A. I took that tour. Different vibe than I'm used to having, spending a lot of time in the Adirondacks and Forest Preserve up that way with a lot of the built infrastructure along the trail and such. But also, you know, it's a different setting. It's a wild forest and it's a Catskill. So there are some maybe adjustments I have to mentally make to be in that sort of a space versus hiking to a high elevation summit, which is what I usually do.
Oh, yeah.
But very pretty and a great resource and a great opportunity for folks to be able to get out there and see the falls and be in the woods and also hang out with their family and friends while they're doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's definitely crazy down there. It's like you said, a different vibe. You definitely from high and like hiking higher up in the higher elevations. I agree.
Yeah. And my view was, I think, the day of the public meeting. So I went there earlier on a Wednesday. So I didn't see peak Saturday or holiday weekend crowds. I've heard about them. I've seen some data to suggest what those numbers are. And yeah. I am looking forward to seeing them later on in the summer when I'm back on site.
Looking forward. It's quotation marks.
I
mean,
you for myself.
You've been in situations like this before, and we'll talk about those. So, I mean, it I don't think it will wow you too much. But today I went local around my area. I went like 30 minutes away and hiked a place called, I don't know how they came up with the name of this. I'll have to look it up, but it's called Forest of the Dozen Dads Preserve. Yeah, definitely going to have to look it up and see why they call it Forest of the Dozen Dads. But that was a nice little hike, just a short little hike around a beaver pond and stuff like that around in some old pines area, the old logging area. And like, it wasn't too bad of a hike. And then all of a sudden, like I said, that smoke started coming in and it started feeling a little like muggy and just like tough to breathe. So we were done with it. And like when we started coming down like west to back to my house, it just started getting worse. It was crazy. It was crazy. So, but yeah, I mean, reading what it says right now, Forest of the Dozen Dads in the town of Middlefield is a reforestation project begun in 1920. 10 students from the Syracuse College of Forestry, as it was then it was called, planted over 4 days. So yeah, I guess it's family owned in the local picnic and nature trail area. That's pretty nice.
Nice.
Yeah. So cool stuff. That's probably the only hike I've done. I need to get out to the Catskills. I think next week we might be going out to the Catskills, so I'll be out there. So nothing too crazy, but I'm glad I didn't go out today. Probably we would have been suffering pretty bad.
Sounds like the right idea.
Remember to volunteer. The 3500 Club has their trailhead stewards going right now. Really cool to see them on the weekends, to see their reports every weekend. Really good thing that they're doing. Catskill Trail Crew, just had a conversation with Matt and Charlie from Catskill Trail Crew, the volunteer organization that does trail work in the Catskills. They are awesome, phenomenal stuff. Check them out. They have dates set up as well. Both places have, I believe they're sign-up geniuses that are, you know, you can easily sign up and then get involved with them. Catskills Visitors Center, the Catskill Mountain Club, all those places volunteer. I take very special, big pride in volunteering. So everybody should volunteer at least twice a year. You know, dedicate 8 hours a year for volunteering is absolutely nothing. So go ahead and do it. So do you want to try? You want me to try to go through this Catskill Mountain history?
Yeah, tell me the story.
Okay, so down in South Carolina, I was on the beach just sitting all day, and I read this book called The Catskill Mountain House. It's about, if you're familiar, you know, if you're studying in that area, you know, right around that area, there used to be a bunch of massive hotels, beautiful, huge 1200 room hotels. And that Clove area was made first for them to access up into the mountain house. Now, at first, it was only available by horse and buggy. And as I've been reading into the book, of course, it's been going with the time, and the horse and buggy kind of was eliminated because of the railroads. The railroads came in and kind of eliminated the horse and buggy, unless you really wanted to, which would be pretty cool, but also very long. But they had railroads going from the south, the west, and the east, going up to this certain spot. So all those locations were bringing people in. The horse and buggy was eliminated on 23A, which I don't think it was called 23A at the time. But after the railroads started coming in, more and more people started going up to the Catskill Mountain House. So this was also brought different crowds because of the cost of it. The cost of going on a train from the Catskill area, the Catskill town, all the way up there was significantly less than taking a horse and buggy for, you know, 4 days that would take you to get from the Hudson River all the way up to the Catskill Mountain House, up to that Clove area. And also at that time, people were seeing that the area that we're talking about tonight, the Catskill Falls areas, was being more populated, being more of a tourist area because of the train stations and stuff. Because now people didn't have to just go up to the Clove area to just stay there. They could just go up for a day and then come back by train the same day, you know, back and forth. So now they saw that the area was starting to become more touristy instead of just a destination place. So it was really neat reading about the different stages of how this was coming about. And then, of course, during the railroads coming in and stuff like that, the motor vehicle started coming in, and now they started thinking about, okay, now we have to take advantage of all these specific spots that we have, like, you know, North Mountain, that beautiful place where you can, North Mountain is Arsus Rock, Catterskill Falls, Haynes Falls, all those places within there. They were like, well, we can actually make a profit from this and advertise this now, because people are going to be able to use their money and come up and see it. But also at the same time, I read that it was on the decline of the Catskill area because of now people could actually travel even further away than by horse and buggy. So the Catskills weren't just a big destination place. It was now the whites in the Adirondacks, and now people were going down south to the Shenandoahs and the coastlines and stuff like that. So now the Catskills, as they were getting somewhat popular, they were also slowly on the demise. And eventually, you know, the horse and buggy came, and then all of a sudden we got a decent amount of people in, but it stayed kind of on a good scale of being a popular touristy area, but also with having the hotels there, it was a popular, I'd say, rich area, basically, because these places weren't cheap. And then all of a sudden, like, it went on a huge decline just because everybody started seeing all these other places in the whites and the Adirondacks, and they decided to travel there, and it got on a huge decline, and then it peaked back up again when the Borscht Belt came back in, and all of a sudden everybody was coming in from New York City and everything. And it was just really crazy to read of, like, the long amount of time that the Catskills was a massive destination area. It was so long, for over like 70, 80 years, that it was just the most popular spot in America, the most beautiful spot in America. And then all of a sudden there's like 10 years where it went huge decline, where people were just like, we don't need to go to the Catskills. Let's go to higher peaks. Let's check out these mountains with open lake tops and stuff like that, and maybe get some views or stuff like that. It's just, it was very odd, but like, I wish I had it all written out, but I just got back from vacation Sunday morning. So I wish I had that, but it's just really neat to see all this. And now, hearing about what's been going on in the past 10 years around here, with the massive overflow of tourists here and the massive overflow of unfortunately, like, the trash and decay, it was really crazy to see that, you know, one time that people were just, very few people went to Catterskill Falls. The only people that did were the people that stayed at the mountain house. And then also read in there that in the winter, you know, maybe like 10 people went to see these places. So Wow. It's just, yeah. Isn't that it? Like, nobody in the winter wanted to travel. I mean, you didn't have the proper equipment or clothes to. So, especially outdoors. So the only people who did that were the hunters and the dedicated. So, not really the craziest Catskill mountain history, but.
No, but it's quite a life cycle.
Yeah. And now what we look, not just the Catskills, but every, you know, national park, every scenic area and stuff like that, how they just shot out the past, you know, 4 years, they shot out the roof with their, you know, population increase, but the tourist increase and just the increase in activity, basically.
We think about it in terms of, I think this is maybe a quote coming from a National Park Service director over time. The Park Service used to be concerned that nobody was visiting, nobody liked the parks enough. And now the concern is that the parks are being loved to death. There's too much visitation. It's up against the capacities of the landscapes. The pressures from visitation are impacting the natural resources and in some ways threatening the mission of the landscapes. And that would sound right for the Catskills as well. And so instead of at all costs, let's bring visitors in, the management perspective has changed to think about, well, hold on a second, maybe we need to think about adaptive management strategies that allow visitors to access without degrading the resource or impacting the experience that other visitors are having in the same space. And so how can we really optimize the visitor experience while also making sure it's of a certain type of quality and character that is in line with the place we're in and the mission behind protecting the place.
Exactly. And then, like, you know, you think back in the days of how little, like, uses, like, the Catskills got, any place in an area has got, and just how overused every area basically is nowadays. You could easily blame that on the population increase, because, you know, we're in the billions now all over the world. And it's just, it has a massive impact. You're starting to get a little more space. And then, of course, social media.
I was going to say, there's been a huge increase in our ability to disseminate information and, you know, easily look up on the internet. Where is this place? What is it? How do I get there? I see reviews. My friends have forwarded it. Let's go check it out. Whereas before, we didn't know of places, right? There were unknown hotspots that pass by word of mouth from population to population in lots of parks and protected areas, the Adirondacks, the Catskills, national parks, etc. You had to be in the place or near it to pick up the right guide or talk to the right person to understand this great opportunity you should go and seek out. And now you can put in a Google search and you can't even read all that Google will pull for you to tell you about this place and what you can do and where you can stay and how to get there. And sometimes firsthand reviews of how to get around the crowds or how to, in some ways, game the system to optimize your own experience, knowing that there's going to be a lot of people and a lot of interest. There are no more secret places anymore. And correct, because it's on the internet, there's no easy way to walk that back or always really control the message or manage the message because it's the internet.
Yeah. And I'm guilty. I'm guilty.
Yeah, me too. I'm sure. Yeah, we all are. We're all a part of the system.
Yeah. And like, you know, I've been to places where I've done a simple Google search. You know, I mean, we've all wanted to go to that place that somebody's posted something that shows a beautiful view of, you know, Utah, or maybe like I've been guilty of the Canadian Rockies. I went up to Moraine Lake and Lake Louise. I mean, how could you not? I advise people to go see those places because I tell people, like, go see it. It's a once in a lifetime thing. So
guilty. And we think about our parks and protected areas in the United States as some of our crown jewels of the country, right? We're a large country. We have a lot of extra space that we decided throughout history to set aside and protect because of the character and quality of that environment. We wanted to preserve that for as a part of our national heritage. And so we should be able to go see these places, and we should want to, and we should encourage, and we should facilitate visitation. But at what extent and to what cost to the resource that we're visiting or the experience we're trying to have? That's the quandary for lots of managers. We think about it as a dual mission or a conflicting mission, where the goal is to protect natural resources in the place that people want to be, but also facilitate visitation and allow visitors in and hopefully facilitate an experience that they enjoy. But there's always that fine balance between too many people, certain types of experiences then impact the resources that we are ultimately and in New York State constitutionally obliged to protect, right?
Yeah. Yeah. See, it all connects itself, right? History connects itself. Crazy. Thanks for listening to my little blurb, and thanks for chiming in, please. Thank you. So want to get some new gear for the Catskills? Say no more. Camp Catskill in Tannersville has everything for your hiking needs. From spikes to snowshoes to moisture wicking shirts to Catskills memorabilia, check Camp Catskill in the Catskills, or check them online as well. They have an online store. I have recently bought like over $100 worth of stuff from there for my next trip to New Hampshire, which is in like 2 days. So check them out. Camp Catskills, awesome place if you're in the area. Also, if you're ready to hit the trails, make sure you take the scenic route. Our guides are here to help you with your goals, big or small. Check out the Scenic Route Guiding and Gear Rentals on Instagram and Facebook for more information. Also, if you mention the podcast, you can get 10% off. Use the code words Mountain Lion. All right, so let's get on to the guest of the night.
Let's go.
So tonight I have Abby. What's your last name? Larkin?
Yes.
Tonight I have Abby Larkin from OTAC. Did I say OTAC correct?
Yeah, you did.
Okay, good. Now, she is involved with the VUM of the Catterskill Clove Area. VUM is the Visitor Use Management, which is going to observe and survey the area and see what we can do to make it a more visitor friendly area. Is that how to say, or how would you say it?
We talk about the goal being sustainable recreation use for the Catterskill Clove project area, which includes the falls and the clove. And so the project's really focused on understanding the visitor experience and the related public safety concerns in the project area, and working through the interagency visitor use management framework and following those steps to build a foundation for a management direction for the project area, establish indicators that we can monitor over time, and then use what we learn about the indicators to inform what would ultimately be adaptive management strategies that are implemented over time and tweaked in response to visitor use conditions. And so there's really a few different steps in there. One is what we're going to do this summer to collect data to understand what current conditions look like. So what are the particular visitor use levels and patterns throughout a day and day to day in the peak summer in the Falls and Clove area. And then once we have an understanding of what current conditions look like, we can compare that to what we will develop through a series of planning workshops with the DEC, which we refer to as desired conditions. So those are statements about what we want the visitor experience to be like in this place. That may be similar to or may be different than what we can tell from our data collection to describe current conditions. And then we'll work with the DEC to develop various management strategies that they can implement and work with partners to implement in order to bridge that gap between current conditions and desired conditions.
Okay, that's a great explanation. It's a long detailed explanation, but it really explains what a VUM is and what you guys are doing. So Abby, why don't you give a little background about yourself? It can involve anything as in like your job or profession or your just life and hiking in general either.
Sure. My name is Abby Larkin. I am a research consultant at OTAC. And OTAC is a research, engineering, landscape architecture, and design firm. It is based out on the West Coast, but it has a specialized group of researchers that specialize in visitor use planning and management. And we, most of us are actually based out of home offices on the East Coast in Vermont and New Hampshire. And so I'm pretty close to the project area, which is great. We often work in places pretty far away, and we have sort of an East Coast advantage and have a lot of familiarity recreating and researching landscapes like in New York State, Vermont, and New Hampshire. And so I joined that team about 6 years ago. And prior to joining the team and entering into this professional space, I was a student at SUNY ESF in Syracuse, the College of Environmental Science and Forestry, the new name for the old school that developed the Dozen Dads Preserve that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was there, I was studying the human dimensions of natural resource management. So I was focused on some of the planning policies and decision-making spaces for complex landscapes like the Catskills and the Adirondacks, where it's not a solid preserve with fixed boundaries and access points, and there are multiple different interests that have a stake in that landscape, what it provides currently and what they want out of it in the future, typically based on having a history with that place as well. So my research there focused on the Adirondacks, and I was really interested in what kinds of information we could provide to decision makers and how could we open up that decision space to include different voices and have a more complex planning process for that place. And at the base of all that, I was trying to collect data that decision makers could use to inform decisions. And so it was my work through graduate school trying to put together data sets and model different use patterns that then I brought those skills into this research position that I have now. And I joined a team that has decades of experience, and we're trained out of Bob Manning's group at University of Vermont. And they've worked in landscapes like Acadia for decades, trying to understand what are some of the key issues and driving factors in that landscape and providing actionable insights that the Park Service could use to inform their decisions and support some somewhat key and controversial decisions like putting forward their transportation plan in the last few years and introducing a timed entry permit system to access the summit of Cadillac Mountain, including the sunrise opportunity up there, which had become a visitor use issue in that park. And so I kind of brought a different perspective into the team and have learned a ton since I've been a part of it and learned how to support the work that we were doing, as well as to introduce some new landscapes like the Adirondacks and the Catskills and some new perspectives to the work we do as well.
And those situations up in Acadia and Maine are very similar to here because those are very tight areas to work in, correct?
Well, I used the Acadia example at the public meeting, and I was told that the Catskills is not like Acadia. And I understand that that is true, that each of these places are unique, but there are enough similarities to provide us with insights as consultants and researchers. And I do think that Acadia has a lot of similarities to the landscapes in New York State, in that Acadia itself is split across really three different blocks of land. The majority of visitation happens to Mount Desert Island, but Mount Desert Island is not completely park ownership, right? There's the mix of private lands in there as well, and different communities that coexist with the park landscape. They think of it as their backyard. They commute through it. So I do think there are similarities there, and similarly positioned interest for that, for the future of that landscape as well.
Yeah, I thought a lot of the places that you guys were talking about in your presentation was very similar to this. It's very, of course, it's all different. You know, out west is way different than out east, of course. And Acadia does have different landscape features than New York, but the situation is very similar as in terms of like the size and what you're dealing with and how is it gonna become a more, I can't think of the words to say. It's just an odd, I can't believe you guys are going to deal with this because it's just tough. And then being at that meeting, seeing it's pretty funny because the meeting was very odd because the ratio of the age ratio was so dramatic. Like I was like, I felt like I was one of the youngest there and I'm 40 years old. And just their comments, I couldn't get over their comments of people saying we got to shut it down. I'm like, I guarantee these people have never been. They only think the Catskills are like this. I'm just like the whole world, United States is overflowing with this. So don't think that it's just the Catskills.
Yeah, these are great examples of what we think about in terms of wicked problems. And this is a technical term from our discipline as well, but wicked problems are problems that have multiple different definitions of a problem, multiple different interests, no real true solution or answer, just a lot of complexity that you need to consider in developing any kind of a management strategy. And so that's why, in part of the framework, we think about it in terms of adaptive management, where you may start with something that's more indirect and implement that and track conditions for a year or so to see how they change in response to that light touch. And then you may elevate to something that's slightly more direct, but always keeping an eye on the impact that the management decision is having on the ground and on the visitor experience and public safety, and then stepping it up and changing your approach as needed and in response to conditions. So continuing to monitor and track on those conditions so that you know what, if any, type of impact that your management decision is having. And if it's not having any or the right type, then adapt accordingly and implement something else that is also informed by the planning process and some data that were collected that describe conditions. So we always like to say too to our clients and to the management agencies that, the data we collect and the reports that we write, they provide information and insights. They don't give you the answer and they don't tell you what to do. That's the privilege of the manager, and we work with our clients to understand what they could do with what we've collected and what it looks like to us may be a good direction or approach and provide recommendations, but we don't deliver an answer, and we certainly don't take the power away from the DEC and other stakeholders who are interested in the future of the landscape.
Awesome. So that's fantastic because, you know, we need recommendations. We just can't have it keep going like this. So
Yeah, but
what
and we also know there are lots of recommendations out there. The Catskill folks are very interested in this part of the park and the park as a whole, and we're trying to build on top of recent efforts like the Catskill Advisory Group put together a great report that had park-wide recommendations and some right for our project area, but lots of park-wide plans and recommendations have been put forward, and they are all on our radar, and we're trying to build on those and assess the feasibility of those based on data we collect. And also, we are looking at it from a specific and different perspective, and so we'll bring those recommendations to bear as well.
awesome. Awesome. Looking forward to it. I'm definitely looking forward to this. So basically, what got you on? What got you into this, your profession at OTEC? Was it your early years at Syracuse and stuff, or?
Yes, my family has a long history of visiting in the Adirondacks. I'm from Ohio, and so we would take the long drive every summer and spend 2 weeks in the Old Forge area. And I loved it. And then I went to college and I studied biology, but I was interested more in the environmental sciences side of biology, but my university didn't really offer a major in that. And so I went with more of the straightforward biological sciences. But then towards the end, in thinking about next steps, I wanted to go into more of a space where it was people and the environment. And I really was interested in some of the problems that the Adirondack Park was facing that I was aware of having spent time there. And at that time in my life, I hadn't been to the Catskills. Old Forge was about as far as my family could make it before we had to stop and spend our vacation. And so the Adirondacks was on my radar. SUNY ESF came up as a place that offered the type of subjects and majors that I was interested in pursuing in grad school. And it offered a setting that I was already interested in and had some interesting questions about. And so I went there, and through my time at ESF, I focused more on the recreation element of the Adirondacks and how that was a key component and a driver of visitation and some of the problems and also some of the opportunities up there. And I started to think a little bigger and think about the national park system and other protected areas that are like the Adirondacks, like the Catskills, but have some different factors to them. I started to think about how does one get into that space? How does the Park Service, who are the social scientists there that are providing them with information on visitors and the role of recreation in their park and in local communities? And then I landed on the work that the team I'm currently a part of was doing in a national park in Cuyahoga Valley National Park, which is near where my family's from in Ohio. So they forwarded this write-up about their work to me. And then I was able to identify the company and the person, and they had a position open, and I applied to it when I finished up my PhD. And I've been working with that team ever since. So in some ways, I started with enough of a direction to land where I am. In other ways, it evolved over time, and I figured out the kind of space I like to work in, the type of work I like to do. And I was lucky enough to find a place to do it with some pretty cool people. And since I joined the team, I've worked in a lot of different national parks and Forest Service settings on our various projects. And now I feel like I've come in some ways full circle, and I'm back in New York State and in working in the Adirondacks and able to work in the Catskills, which is pretty cool.
Nice. Nice. Now, you said you have a PhD, so should I call you Dr. Abby Largan?
You don't have to.
Okay.
I don't lead with that.
Okay. Like I remember seeing some of my friends, and they're just like, now that they become a doctor, they're just like, Dr. Fernandez. I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to call you Ryan. I'm not calling you doctor.
You can call me Abby.
Good. You're one of the few. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Larkin. So with these places that you've worked at, where have you been successful? Where you can give some examples of a successful project that you have dealt with?
Yeah. So, and I'll start by offering that there are many different definitions of success, right?
True.
And so in some ways, a successful project for us is delivering on the contract that we've been hired to deliver on. And so provided we, fulfill the terms of the contract or go above and beyond, then we've been successful. If we've collected the data, we've delivered the report, we've given the presentation, we've workshopped the results with the planning team or decision makers, and they are entrusted to move forward with what we've provided in whatever space they're available to do so, then that's a successful project. And that happens every time we have a project. We implement different steps of the visitor use management framework to collect data that describe current conditions, to evaluate visitor perceptions of current conditions, to assess current conditions in the context of other studies and planning frameworks that we're aware of, to provide insights and recommendations to our clients and the management or decision-making portion of their space. That's a successful project. I think taking it to a next level, when we're able to do repeat work in places with people Like, we have a long history of working in places like Acadia and Mount Rainier. We've had repeat projects recently in Arches National Park. That feels even more successful when we've been able to deliver on our first contract enough to warrant follow-up contracts with those clients that build on work we delivered, but ask for the next step that suggests that those folks have really engaged with the material we've provided. They see the value in it and they've come back for more. And that feels really successful as a professional to be able to do that for our team. And then, as I was just saying, I feel personally and professionally successful being able to bring my professional work back into the Adirondack and now into the Catskill space as well.
Nice. So, like, when doing this sort of work, what place has been very, very, like, difficult that you're just like, wow, this is going to be a definitely challenge, but you have overcome that challenge? Like, I couldn't even imagine now. It's just any place now, but, you know, I could imagine out west, Arches has got to be, because that's a tough area to work in, probably.
Well, this work definitely keeps the team on their toes, because every place we work is a little different, right? They have their own use patterns and quirks and environmental conditions. Working from Acadia to Mount Rainier to Arches are very different settings. But that excites our small team. You know, we really like the challenge of digging into a new space, figuring out what it is, applying what we know from previous studies, and then also adapting and delivering on what we need to that's unique to this place. Right now, we're considering how to get around a park in the southeast that has a loop road network that runs one way, and we want to collect information on parking in many different parking lots around that loop. And so we're thinking about how to do that with a team and bikes so they can get around. That's not something we always do or frequently do, but that's something we think is a solution warranted for the data collection called for on this project. And so, you know, it's exciting to us to continuously look at a new place, think about it like a system, break it down into its components, and try to figure out solutions for how we're going to collect information, distill it, and present it back to our client. But I will say some of the environmental hazards can be challenging, like the heat out in Arches. Oh, yeah. We had to make sure those teams have plenty of sunblock and shade protectors and water at their disposal to make sure the team is in, it feels like they're in a good spot when they're doing the great work that they're doing. We've also had to react to bad weather events and storm. Different members of my teams will tell stories about like waiting for the thunder to stop before they can get out of the environment. I've heard from a colleague, he was placed out in, I think, Denali National Park in the backcountry, intercepting visitors to complete a survey, and decided he needed to get out of his survey location because there were some wolves around that weren't going away. So those kind of things happen when you do work out in protected areas, sometimes in the backcountry, sometimes in extreme conditions like that. We've done previous projects in Zion. I wasn't there personally, but there were some times the team had to get out because of flash floods that happened in the canyons. And so we do take safety very seriously, and we think about how best to get the team in and out and keep them safe at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What about like places, like specific places that has been most difficult to do your research and stuff like that? And do you have any specific spots there where you've been like, man, this is definitely going to be a challenge with, you know, what you're working with?
Yeah, sometimes it can be a challenge depending on the landscape itself. If the place where we need to get to collect the data is pretty remote and hard to access, then it can take a long time to get back in position to collect the information that you want. We did some work previously in the Adirondacks and the High Peaks where we wanted to collect counts of people at one time on summits, including Marcy, and you can't get up to Marcy, do an 8-hour count, and get back down. And so we were lucky enough to work with some field technicians that were comfortable backcountry camping throughout the study. So we'd send them up for a long weekend. They'd camp day to day. They'd write down their counts. They would text me a picture of it so we knew we had the data, and they would carry on day to day and then take a break during the week. And so, you know, we look for creative solutions to things like that. We also will design data collection protocols that are as light as can be while still getting, you know, the information that we want so that we don't overly burden anyone that we're working with, whether it's staff or land managers. And we don't set expectations too high for what you're going to get out of, you know, some data collection location that's remote, takes a long time to get to, and frankly, maybe not a lot of visitors are going to get to during your study. Our studies also tend to focus on front country access points, because that is where more of the visitor use pressures tend to be found, tend to be concentrated. And so we don't do as much of our studies or work in like true wilderness backcountry areas just for that reason.
Interesting. Interesting. So there definitely has to be a pleasure for you guys to do this, to go out and look at a place and be like, wow, this needs a lot of help. And then actually be successful in it. Like you're just like, it's like going into an old store and being like, damn, okay, this needs a lot of work. I really don't want to deal with this. But you guys, especially, you know, with also taking on the heat from the locals and stuff like that in the area, because I mean, most of the time they think they know what's best for the area, and they really, most of the time they don't. it's really funny. But like I said, there's got to be a crazy pleasure to look at a place and be like, man, this is a disaster, but at also the same time, this will be fun. Like,
yeah, it's pretty rewarding to be able to problem solve and try to think it through. And, you know, we don't fix everything overnight. We don't fix it within a project, quote unquote fix, right? We do what we can to set up the planning team with the framework and an understanding of how to approach problems, how to implement solutions in the short and long term, and how to continue to track on the impact of those solutions so that they can adapt into the future. Because it's never a one and done type of a project in the Catskills, the Adirondacks, or in any other place. Typically, our projects start because a landscape has a research question or a concern, or is at the very least tracking on increasing visitor use levels over time, whether they are measuring them or they just have the strong sense that there are more and more people doing this or that in this place year to year, and they want to understand it before it grows even more. And that's great. That is an important trigger for a manager to take notice and take action. And that first step is often just measuring what's out there. So we know, what is that increase year over year? How many people actually are there on the summit or down in the swimming hole compared to anecdotal evidence that there are tens of hundreds of thousands at a time? Maybe, maybe not. We don't have any information that actually describes that condition. So let's get that on the books first. Let's know what that is. Let's establish that baseline and many other measures like that, whether it's traffic volumes, parking accumulation, volumes on trails, concentrations of visitors in one place or another. Let's get all that on the books and know what we're talking about and be able to describe the setting and some of the relationships between the components of the setting. And with that strong understanding built, we can then look at what are some of the levers that managers can pull that will actually have an impact on what's happening in the landscape. So for example, if a major concern is the amount of garbage in different places in the Falls and Clove area, either along 23A because of the use that's happening, or Laurel House Road and along the trails. I know garbage stations have been added recently, but there, I've heard comments at the public meeting, it's still an issue. There's not enough. There's not a long-term plan for how to manage that type of infrastructure. And there's also questions about whether that's appropriate in a wild forest type of setting or not. But we also know from the research that we've done that you can have a garbage problem with one visitor or 10 visitors that don't know how to best recreate in this space, how to leave a light touch, how to find the nearest garbage can, how to take their garbage out with them. That's an educational message that can be given to 1 to 10 to 100 to 1,000 people and can have a real impact. You don't need to escalate to 1,000 visitors an hour and then track that against a garbage issue. That garbage issue can result from a low level of use, from visitors who aren't properly informed about best use practices in that landscape. And so we like to understand what those use level relationships are to understand how best to manage use levels and access points, if that is the proper solution to the problem. And if it's not, what are some other alternatives that DEC can look at and work with partners to implement to try to reduce the visitor, the pressures relating from increasing visitor use, either along the roadway, in parking areas, or inside of the trail system and primary destinations themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. So once you guys started with this, we had our first public meeting. What are the other steps that goes into this? I'm looking over one of my pictures and I took a picture of the steps. A lot of people weren't there at that meeting, and a lot of people, you know, I've posted links, but probably don't know what the step is going to be as in year over year. I think this is what, or no, it's not year, but your process map basically. Take your time and go look at that. And you could start explaining what that process map is going to be like, because that's what I found the most interesting about that meeting, is that process map.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we do encourage listeners to go to CatterskillCloveUM.com. Hopefully you'll have that posted somewhere on this podcast as well. That's the website we launched to report out on the progress of this project and make sure the public is aware of what we're doing, what are the components of the project. There's some links to foundational information about the visitor use management framework to try to unpack some of those terms. There's an opportunity for visitors to provide general comments or share their questions, as well as to respond to certain prompts. And then we will be updating that website throughout the life of this project. We do have a 2-year contract with DEC that started at the beginning of this year, so it'll run through the end of 2024. And we've got a lot of things going on in that 2-year timeline, some of which we've already gotten a great start on in our first couple months on this contract, which would include the public meeting that you referenced. And prior to that, we launched into our planning efforts with a team that consists of DEC staff that was identified as our state project team. So we've been doing some internal workshop planning with them. We have conducted 2 out of 4 of those, so there's 2 more to come. The 2 that are coming and our next public meeting were sequenced to come after. We'll be on site this summer to collect data to describe current conditions. Once we've collected that, we'll take a good amount of time to review those data, understand the relationships that we've modeled, work through that with DEC, and then move that information and those insights forward into discussions about management strategies. And so we need some time to sit with that information, process it with the DEC, and then we'll put that information back out for the public. So that explains why there's a gap between our first public meeting, which was May of this year, and then our second of 2 public meetings, which I believe is going to be, I think, March of 2024 is what the project map should say. Yeah, March.
Yep.
So in and around that, we'll have our planning workshops with the state project team. And we also have some ongoing, more targeted stakeholder engagement, which will be with specific stakeholder representatives that were identified by working with the DEC. And some of those representatives are similar to the Catskill Advisory Group representatives, but there are others as well that were brought on, and we'll be engaging with them throughout and at certain key touch points in the process to make sure that we have their input when we need it, and to make sure that they have a heads up about what's coming out so that they can weigh in as needed and help to guide the project as well.
So now after when you're doing all this research and stuff like that, like on-site research, will it be a little, of course it'll be probably a little bit of everything, maybe like in-person interviews, like interviews with people that are visiting, stations, we have stations set up at like different access points and stuff and areas, or is it just basically people going out and checking out, observing what's going on?
Yeah, we're going to be collecting direct observations of visitor use numbers and visitor behaviors in key areas in the Falls and Clove. We're also going to be working with DEC, and already have, to leverage their existing trail counter equipment and put out a traffic counter as well. So we'll have those counts of incoming trail and traffic volumes into the system. And then we are currently developing a survey that we'll administer on-site to visitors. We're also going to be collecting data on visitor use patterns. So once visitors park in the Laurel House Road lot, where do they go? What share goes just to the platform? What share goes all the way down to 23A? What share arrives at 23A or exits from there and doesn't come back to Laurel House? How long do people tend to stay in that area? Is it 10 minutes? Is it an hour? Is the max length of stay 5 hours because they went along the escarpment trail? We want to understand some of the fundamentals about visitor use levels and patterns in that area, with a focus on the Falls area and then some of the access points off of 23A.
Nice. Now, how long will that data be gathering taken in for? Like a year and a half or a year?
Well, we're going to be on site collecting the data for about a tight 2 week period in July is what our target is. We do tend to have a limited time frame for data collection. We try to get out there on a typically busy period of the season. So we don't need to know what the worst case scenario looks like, but we do want to observe what happens to the system under pressure when there are a lot of people trying to get in, get their parking spot, have their experience, and get back out. We want to know what that crowding and congestion looks like and observe some of the issues that result from that. So we're planning to be there in July, and we'll collect the information that we can on site. We'll use the counting equipment that's out there for longer than just the July period. And we are also gathering up any other existing data for this project area. So we have a stockpile of previous studies and surveys that have been conducted. So we're not trying to reinvent the wheel on anything. We're also not closing ourselves out to only what we can collect ourselves, but growing that data set as much as we can to be able to speak to current conditions.
Nice. So basically, like, you know, other stuff like stewards reports, ranger reports, stuff like that is all going to be thrown into one big pile.
Yes. Yep. And yeah, the search and rescue incident reports is a primary data input that we have been looking at for previous years. And we'll certainly want to know what happens this summer when we're on site. That's not data we need to collect. It's already being documented and we'll fold that right into this study.
Nice. Nice. Sounds absolutely crazy. And then, and then, you know, you have the public meetings and it looks like in the fall, you have a public comment. What's that like? Basically, is that the analysis of everything? And then you're going to throw what you guys have come up with in that? Or is that a little bit later?
That public comment will be a public comment on the draft final report that we'll have put together that describes the area, reports the outcomes of our planning workshops with the DEC project team, includes a summary of the data we collected this summer and analysis of those data, which support whatever recommendations we would have in that report. That will go out for a standard DEC public comment where anyone and everyone is encouraged to provide their comments on the report. And then we'll work with the DEC to revise the report, to respond to comments that we receive from the DEC and the general public comment period. And we'll produce a final report after that. And that really marks the end of our project to deliver a final report, which will also include a monitoring plan going forward. But that's not anywhere close to the end of the visitor use management process in the Catterskill Clove and Falls area and elsewhere in the Catterskills. It's really a first important step the DEC is taking to get this contract underway, walk through the visitor use management framework with our support, and then walk away with this report, monitoring plan, and the embedded recommendations that they can carry forward as they continue to address visitor use issues in this area.
Now, being how long you've been here doing this specific area? It's been only a couple of months, right?
Yeah, I think we got our contract underway maybe January.
Now, what are your insights so far as in like being a couple months into it? Is it like this is going to be really, really cool and interesting to work with? Or is this, I mean, of course I can edit this out. Is this going to be a train wreck and, you know, it's going to be one of the toughest we've dealt with?
No, we're really excited about this opportunity. There's a lot of interesting things going on that we want to understand better and be able to document. We see a real need for some of that documentation and description of existing conditions that will help community members, other stakeholders, as well as the DEC to plan going forward. Just having that baseline is extremely valuable. And we can see that being important in this area as well. And then developing an understanding of what those relationships are and where there aren't relationships, but other opportunities for visitor education and interpretation to help to address some of the more acute issues that aren't related to increasing visitor use pressures, but are important to understand and address in the project area.
Yeah.
So now we're excited. We think this is not an outlier project from our body of work. This fits right in there along with everything else. We're excited that this is close to home for the majority of our team based in home offices in Vermont and New Hampshire. I'm excited that I can drive over there and go to the project area and scope it out as I did for the public meeting and as I'll do again throughout the summer versus have to fly somewhere pretty far away, absorb it while I can while I'm on site. You know, we use a lot of Google Earth and Google Maps to try to do some remote scouting as much as we can, but that's not the equivalent to seeing a place firsthand and seeing the dynamics of the space. And so I'm excited for it to be nearby and to feel like I have a head start in understanding a lot of the context, having lived in New York State and worked with the DEC and in those landscapes before.
Yeah.
So not and like a train wreck.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I would look forward to doing this as well. So one thing you mentioned earlier was education. And I agree with you. A lot of this is because the people are uneducated. And back in, I'm trying to remember, I think it was 2020 when this place exploded due to the pandemic, number one, and number two, just, you know, social media. I found that a lot of people are just coming up here just to hang and then doing whatever they want, of course, because they're not educated. They're not educated to bring maybe a garbage bag and then just bring your stuff home and throw it out when you get home. They just think that it's going to be like the city. It's going to be thrown out on the side of there's a trash can somewhere and that they can throw it out there. I'm like, oh, there is no trash can here, so I'll just leave it on the side of the road. So I agree with you in that, and that a lot of this involves education.
Yeah, visitors bring different expectations to new spaces that differ within and among the visiting population. And those aren't going to change overnight or because some folks wish that they were different. And there's a great deal of interpretive signage and educational messages that are happening in the landscape, but they may not be of the right message or the right style. And so we can understand that better in order to really get at some of the key issues without taking away from what's already there in the landscape. And in fact, by enhancing how people can experience and appreciate the place by really sharing what is at the heart of the conservation legacy for Catterskill Clove and the Catskills as a broader location. And we've talked a lot internally and with the teams about really instilling an interest in and support for continued and future conservation with folks who haven't thought about it before or don't know or think that this place is like some other place they've been and don't understand how it's different and how what the state is doing to protect and manage the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not, I'm trying to think of the words. It's not all like easy as everybody thinks it should be. Like it's not easy to see this place explode, and because of it's such a small area, that to have it under control, like everybody said, oh, you know, it should be under control already. Like, no, it's a very difficult, and that's why we bring professionals like you guys to come in, to observe what's going on and then recommend, like, hey, you know, not saying this is the solution, but maybe the parking area should be over here. Or maybe, you know, a lot of people said that it should be permits like we did in the Blue Hole. But once again, it's a very difficult process. And I definitely understand, but a lot of people don't understand that how difficult it is to get some small place like this under control with such an overflow of people.
And how to get it to meet the expectations of a diverse visiting population. Because the folks who think there's one solution that will fix it, it may be the solution that fixes it for them, but that solution may really compromise someone else's opportunity to be there and what they want out of that space. And that's worth considering as well. There's what the place is, why it was protected, what type of experience managers want visitors to have, and that could be along a spectrum. And then how do we manage for that kind of experience or that spectrum of experiences and opportunities? And it's more complex and wicked than build a new parking space and everything will be fixed. And so that, and I'm not saying that's not a potential recommendation or solution to a part of the problem, but it's not the silver bullet that will resolve everything happening in the Clove.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just crazy. A lot of people don't realize, especially like the people who have newly come here and stuff like that, and some people who have been here a long time, that these places are thriving. These small towns around here are thriving on the tourism. That's what they are thriving on. And simply to, you know, shut a place down or limit to this is going to kill those small towns. And especially that area. That area is Tannersville and Hunter. Hunter's based really on the ski mountains, but Tannersville and Hunter thrive on tourism. It's basically what it is.
Yeah. For any management strategy, there's always going to be a degree of trade-off, right? Yeah. And we keep that in mind as we offer recommendations, what good a recommendation may do, and also what are some of the trade-offs and the consequences that come along with it. And then we can consider a suite of recommendations and strategies and think about what's best for the future of the landscape in line with what we want the place to be like and what kind of experience we want it to offer. And some decisions and actions may be quite forthcoming and comfortable, and others may be a little more difficult, and they may not happen right away. They may happen over time. It may be the solution we work toward if we can't manage current conditions using other more indirect strategies.
Yeah. So it'll definitely be very interesting as hopefully we all, I really wish people would stop looking at like the straight picture and look at all the different options that they have, like you guys are throwing out there, you know, and the answers that you had at the public meeting. You know, it's a lot of people haven't explored outside of the Catskills and stuff and seen the impact that has gotten from the national parks and from the local parks as well. So it can be good and it can be bad.
And the visitor use management framework is a paradigm shift for DEC. This isn't how they've thought about managing the forest preserve in the past. But this is what the national parks and other federal landscapes are using to manage. So that's a paradigm shift for the DEC. There are also inherent paradigm shifts with the local communities and other stakeholder interests, because this isn't how DEC has approached land management or visitor use management before. They haven't at all. So this is, it's fundamentally different. It could be uncomfortable for lots of folks. This project is standing on a solid foundation of other places who have adopted this approach, either because they've employed us to do it or they've worked with other universities, institutions, or consulting firms. There aren't that many, but there are the tried and true group like ours that work across the country doing this exact same thing. And often repeating our work in locations that need to move on to the next step and continue to advance their approach to visitor use management. So the Catskills and the Adirondacks are in good company, and we really applaud the DEC for taking on this effort and looking at the visitor use management framework as a paradigm shift, but also a structured framework for thinking strategically and really carefully about what to do with this space going forward.
Agreed. definitely agree. I really I really agree with you on that one, that DEC looking at this and saying, hey, we definitely need some outside help for this and to see what we can do to get this under control. So where has been your favorite experience in doing this type of work so far?
Oh, well, I mean, I do love working back in the Adirondacks. It gives me a little bit of a chill to be back there applying my professional skills. But I also really, I love the opportunity to work in different landscapes and to see some of the national parks. I've been on site to launch efforts in Hot Springs and Arches and Joshua Tree and Mount Rainier and Acadia a couple of times. So it's been great. It's been great to tour other protected areas. I spent it in New York State, often in the Adirondacks, but elsewhere. Spent some time living in New Hampshire, and so I was up in the Whites. Now in Vermont, there's a lot at my disposal too. And, you know, it's not bad when work sends you to Mount Rainier.
Yeah. So not based on OTAC, but where has been your favorite place you have visited so far besides the Adirondacks? Let's leave the Adirondacks out.
Oh, well, then I would have to say I really like the opportunities in my home base of Vermont. And I was thinking about this earlier with your plug from Molly, who does photo shoots and elopements. My husband and I got married on Mansfield during the pandemic. We took a hike with a coworker and decided this is us and we're going to do it. And so that place will always be very special.
Vermont is stunning. I got to admit, the East Coast is like no other. The Northeast, sorry to say, but anything Shenandoah and above is like no other. I mean, I've been to Zion and I just went to Zion last year and I thought it was fantastic and want to explore more in Canadian Rockies, California. You know, I've been all over the place, but I keep saying like the Northeast is like nothing else.
Yeah. We just settled permanently buying our home last year in Vermont and decided despite other opportunities and places we could go, this is where we want to be. And I like its proximity to the Adirondacks. I like what Vermont offers. I like the vibe and the outdoor opportunities. I like the proximity to the Whites. My husband really likes the mountain biking opportunities, so he doesn't really need to go anywhere else, but we're in a good spot.
Vermont is right there with everything. You're correct. Are you located like in the central Vermont, lower upper Vermont? So, I mean, if you're close to Adirondacks, you're probably a little bit lower.
We're just outside of Burlington.
Oh, nice. Ooh, right there.
North and west, yeah.
Geez, you're like in the central circle of everything. Nice.
Yeah. Just there's a lake in the way sometimes, but it's okay.
Yeah. Got to go around that, unfortunately. Oh, the ferry. Do they have a ferry across going from Burlington to...
There are some ferry routes still, yeah. And you can drive through the islands in the lake as well and get over to New York.
Okay. I haven't been up there in a very long time.
You should come.
Yeah, definitely got to go back up there. So with being with OTAC and stuff, where do you think OTAC and your profession has been like the largest impact, like has been kind of like the most successful?
Well, we've had a long history of and a solid portfolio work in Acadia. They keep inviting us back to do more, to bite off a little chunk of that park and understand its dynamics and provide some insights and recommendations. So that's that legacy goes back to before the professional group was founded, and the folks who founded the group were graduate students at the University of Vermont, and then adjunct or tenured faculty in other institutions, and then moved on to the consulting work. So we've done a lot of great work there, and it's been great to be a part of it. That's again a complex landscape with lots of dynamics and a pretty large visitor base that is expecting different things out of that place and also the nearby communities. We've done some great work there. We've also, as a team, not myself personally, but have over a decade's worth of work in Mount Rainier that has provided insights over time and was recently brought back to the surface to pretty heavily inform their Nisqually to Paradise visitor use management plan that just came out in a draft form. So that's the culmination of a lot of really thoughtful and hard work that was developed over the last decade to try to do our best to inform some of those management decisions. So that's been a great thing to join as I joined this team, and then kind of see it to the point where it is now informing that plan. I hate to say this in front of the Catskill and the Adirondack communities, but we've also been able to work in many of the parks that have recently launched some type of managed access, whether it's timed entry or a permit system, to try to bring down the levels of congestion and crowds in order to ensure a high quality visitor experience and a safe visitor experience as well. And so we collected data on the Angel's Landing Trail that helped, that gave the park really the scientific basis to inform what a permit system might look like there. We did the same thing for Arches recently with their timed entry system. And that, you know, those are based on data we collected in the field, relationships we analyzed, often computer simulation models that we construct as well. So those aren't decisions that are made lightly by anybody. A lot of good, hard thought goes into those decisions, and quite often the data we collect supports it as well. And thinking back even more, you know, one of the pivotal examples of the work that my director did that I didn't directly do because it was too many years ago, but he was a part of the team that collected data and produced a computer simulation model for hikers going up to Half Dome in Yosemite.
I was going to say that I was like, you guys are probably involved in that. Yeah. Awesome. Good.
And that turned around really quickly to inform a permit system to do that hike, to ensure that visitors could safely get up those cables, which don't look safe to me when I look at photos of them. So I think most folks could look at that and see the potential for a safety hazard, as well as ensuring that there was the right amount of people at any given time such that they could evacuate if there was a hazardous thunderstorm hitting the summit.
Oh, yeah.
So a couple of different dimensions to safety issues there, which are really important, to preserve safety when folks are in the backcountry like that.
Yeah. And that's not a lot of people look at that. Not a lot of people look at like, oh my God, there's a storm coming in and we need to get these people off of here, especially places in like Half Dome where they're exposed. And if you have too many people up there, it's just going to be a mass horrible event of everybody trying to push everybody to get down. Wow. Never thought of that.
We've also did a great project with the Castillo de San Marcos in St. Augustine, Florida. This is a National Park Service monument property where it's an old historic fort on the coast of St. Augustine. And so it's a built environment. It doesn't have summits. It doesn't have waterfalls. But it's a fort that visitors come and experience and understand the historic use patterns there, the different countries that owned and operated it as an outpost over time, and a lot of the different cultural connections to that space. And so the team worked with the Castillo de San Marcos to understand use levels and patterns. You know, once a visitor enters this historic fort, where are they going? What's their pattern? Are they conflicting with other visitors going in other directions? Is there a better way to manage visitor circulation and flow in this space to enhance the visitor experience? Because we can also look at numbers of people in different rooms and what the density of visitation is like in those spaces. And if density reaches a point such that visitors can no longer interact with the interpretive displays in that space because there's too many people. So very different than crowding on a trail or at a waterfall summit, but still very valuable and speaks to this, to a different type of, but the same concept of the visitor experience and how do we maintain and preserve that and provide for that by, you know, collecting information that describes conditions, thinking critically about what we can do to indirectly or directly improve those conditions, and what can that do for the overall number of visitors that we can accommodate day to day, and the quality of the experience that we're able to provide for visitors, while also protecting the resource or the infrastructure that we have in the park setting. That place also was really interested in learning more from those cultures and communities that the monument aimed to reflect and speak to, but they had an awareness that maybe they weren't doing the best job, and they wanted to invite those communities in to share their stories and share their perspectives to improve and enhance what the monument was able to offer. So that was a really great, very different type of project, but used some of our same skills and modeling steps. And I think, provided some really valuable insights to that landscape without needing to address visitor use levels or in some ways reduce the overall amount of people that could be accommodated. There's another place that we were just looking at that is the landscape for the park has sand dunes. And so they don't have similar natural resource protection limitations like other places. Sand is pretty hardy. You can put a lot of people on sand and it's still sand. And so they have an opportunity to think about building a better parking lot for more people without damaging natural resources, but only to the extent that they haven't then overloaded the number of people in their space. And so they wanted to better understand what their conditions were like for crowds on the dunes and what visitors' perceptions of crowding were. And if you think about a dune setting, it's very possible for there to be a lot of people spread out such that you don't have that sense of crowding and congestion. Mm-hmm. And so if we can accommodate more people, then there's justification for building a bigger parking lot. And if we build a bigger parking lot in this setting, we're not impacting the natural resources. So that's a different kind of problem and system and outcome than we tend to look at, just to provide a little bit more of a spectrum from the permit and managed access places that we do work quite often, but it's not the only type of thing that we do. And we like to work in other spaces and think about other types of problems.
Yeah. Like not everything is permit and stuff like that. That's what everybody thinks that it's going to come down to.
Yeah, that's everyone's concern. I think at both public meetings, I asked pretty frankly, is this project a justification for that type of an outcome? And while that outcome is not off the table for either project area, it's not the foregone conclusion of any project. We're going to do our due diligence to understand the dynamics of the system, understand and articulate those desired conditions from the management perspective, and then follow the visitor use management framework to support the DEC to develop informed management strategies. Yeah. And they may include at some point in time those types of a managed access approach, and they may not. We don't know until we've taken a look at the data and we have some of the results in hand.
Exactly. Exactly. You can't just make a decision based on nothing and just be like, I saw this one day. We need a permit system. But, you know, some of the places like you guys worked with, I understand, you know, Angel's Landing and Half Dome, both overcrowded before the permit system came in, and just the amount of space that you have to go up those two areas are insane, and it needed to be done. I wouldn't want to be on Angel's Landing with six people trying to run up there because they're trail runners and they want to just summit and get down. So definitely understanding. So excellent. Great examples. And you said, I remember at the meeting, you said Acadia National Park was like the most visited national park, correct?
I don't know that it's top, but it's definitely up there. Okay. Usually we can do a quick search of the top.
Of course, yeah.
Top national parks.
I remember you said it was very well visited. And I was surprised by Acadia because I'm just like, that's in Maine. That's not Zion or Yosemite or something like that. But
no, but it's a big attraction if you think about it for the Northeast, right? We don't have that many national parks up here. And it is one of the crown jewels. It's an old national park. It's unique to the Northeast. It also gets a lot of, or has historically gotten a lot of visitation from cruise ships that cruise up and down the coast and will drop all their passengers off in Bar Harbor, and they all spend their day in Acadia. And so that's a big pulse of visitation that the park is looking at how to accommodate as well.
Nice. Oh, the Great Smoky Mountains are the number one with 12 million. Wow. Acadia is 2, 4, 6, 7th. So Acadia is 7th.
It's up with there.
With over 3 million. Wow. And now I remember just seeing it stuff. It's over 4. So it's above Grand Tetons and Glacier and stuff, which is absolutely insane because, like, it's such a small area and it's up in Maine. You know, it's away from major cities and stuff like that. So it's a desired area. Let's just say that.
And, you know, we think about the 4,000-footer challenges and the Catskills and the High Peaks, folks that want to have the experience, check items off a list. visiting the national parks and the top national parks is a goal of a lot of folks, and they want to get there and see each one of them. And so that drives a lot of traffic as well.
Yeah. Awesome. So Abby, I got one more question for you. This is, it's called post-hike bruise and bites. My friend Mary suggested this. So when you're out locally, I mean, it doesn't have to be the Catskills. If you've been somewhere in the Catskills, that'd be great. But if you suggest a place to get something to eat and drink after you've gone on a local hike or something, what would you suggest?
Well, I think it was called the Circle W, where I had an amazing sandwich after spending a day and a half
in the
Caddo
Snowfall
Enclosed area. Like, I'm a vegetarian, and this was like a seitan-based Reuben sandwich. It's rare to get a big, warm, filling vegetarian sandwich when you're out in a different place that you're not used to, in a smaller community as well. So that was clutch and a great. I think I had a iced chai as well.
Nice. Like, there's somebody else suggests that. I'm gonna have to go back over my notes and see who suggested the Circle W.
Somebody had just suggested it to me, someone who worked for the DEC, who didn't even know that I needed a place to eat right then. It's like, oh, check this place out. And it was great.
Nice. Yeah. I'm gonna have to go over my notes, because I'm just like, wow, that's great. But what about a local place up in Vermont near Burlington that you want a great restaurant?
Oh, well, again, as a vegetarian, we actually, I had my family visiting this weekend, and we took them to a great restaurant in the town of Winooski, which is right next to Burlington, and it's called the Mule Bar. And it serves a lot of, you know, mule drinks like you would expect, and has really good burgers, and it makes an impossible burger, which is good for vegetarian, and really, really good French fries.
Good. Excellent. I will plug them both into here. So, Abby, thank you very much for joining me tonight. I really appreciate you taking your time and explaining this process that you guys are going through. And I look forward to seeing your research and results and hearing everything along the way. I thank you. This is going to be very interesting. I look forward to it.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having us. Thanks for supporting the project and being interested in what we're doing. I'm happy to talk about visitor use management and all the great places I've been able to work, and you know what we think we can do for the Catskills and the Catterskill Clove. So please continue to plug and support our project. I hope your listeners get out there and provide their public comment, and also hopefully their public support for what's happening as well.
Agreed. I agree. Definitely do that, everyone, and whoever's listening. Thank you to the monthly supporters. Really appreciate you guys. Thank you to everyone who has donated to the show. Thank you to the monthly sponsors. I really appreciate you guys. And I also thank everyone who is listening. And Abby, once again, thank you for joining me tonight. And I hope you have a good night.
Thank you. You too. It's my pleasure.
All right. Bye.
Hey guys, I just want to thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe and throw down a smooth review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any podcast platform that you use. You can also check daily updates of the podcast, hikes, hiking memes, and local news on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and the official website of the show. Remember this, you just keep on living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Wicked, 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 wicked.